Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Now today, a very interesting subject we're covering, and we're going to be talking about the fraternities. And I've seen so many things on TV about it, and so many different issues with it, and it's a very unique thing to the United States. And a book that I came across was True Gentlemen, and it's The Broken Pledge of American Fraternities, and John Hechinger is the author, and he's joined us here. So welcome, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Alan, Kevin. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Now, first, before you got into, how did you get involved in writing about the fraternities and get involved in the whole industry, we'll call it?
I wrote a series of articles at Bloomberg News, where I work as a reporter and editor with a colleague. We looked at deaths at fraternities over almost a decade. Also started trying to figure out which fraternity had the biggest problem. And in the end, we focused on one very large organization, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, which became the focus of my book.
What is a fraternity supposed to be about? What is it supposed to do for students?
Well, fraternities are about brotherhood, and many young men turn to fraternities when they arrive on campuses. And fraternities are more popular than they've ever been. There are something like 400,000 members. It's a 50% increase over the last decade. And many students find that, particularly at a big and personal public university, they are kind of thirsting for real human contact and for a kind of a ready-made group that will see them through their 4 years. And many find the organizations to be helpful in that way. They're also an incredible career network that help them get involved in student government and internships, and can also catapult them into Congress and even the presidency and the Supreme Court. So there's many reasons why people are attracted to them. But as I found in researching the book, from the beginning, they've also had this dark side. I call it the sort of holy trinity of deadly drinking and racism and sexual assault. And these are issues that have, you know, from the beginning of the movement, which began in the 19th century, this has been something that they've had real trouble with and have been struggling with, probably never more than today.
So is this something that just sort of has turned in the last 20 years, or has this been going on all along? Because I ask that because there seems to be a lot of tradition with fraternity, and a lot of these drinking contests and different things that they have, and hazing and initiations have been going on for years now.
Right. You know, how did this begin?
Well, that's certainly true. If you think about hazing, I mean, hazing goes back to the Greeks, and in the United States, we imported hazing from British boarding schools where older students preyed upon younger students. And what fraternities added was sort of an institutionalized period of hazing called pledging, where new members would be kind of second-class citizens and have to sort of go through a gauntlet of challenges to prove their worthiness and their manhood. And this is something that really intensified after the Civil War and has been a problem really forever. Hank Noor, who is a hazing expert and a professor, has chronicled that these deaths going back really to the 60s and before, and there have been at least one hazing death every year. Last year there were four, and you know, over the last decade there have been as many as seven in a year. So this is something that has been going on for a long time. In terms of sort of the modern era, fraternities kind of almost died out in the 60s and 70s in the counterculture. But there was kind of a boom back in the 80s, and people trace it to a number of phenomena. One, strangely enough, is the movie Animal House, which was supposed to be a satire and a parody.
Exactly.
But many viewed it as kind of an inspiration. So that helped sort of rejuvenate the fraternity movement. Another reason that fraternities became more popular was that the drinking age went from 18 to 21 in the 80s, sort of state by state. And that made it more difficult for students to get alcohol, and fraternities sort of bravely went into the breach and became kind of the bartenders on campus. That also made them quite popular and kind of cemented their power at the center of college campuses. But it also intensified all these problems. And I talk a lot in the book about how, again, the national organization started worrying that fraternities were so dangerous. Insurance companies had rated them about the same as toxic waste dumps in terms of risk, that fraternities couldn't get insurance and might have actually went out of business again. And as I discuss in the book, that's been a struggle.
Now, I have a statement, and I want you to tell me what you think about it. And I've heard this a lot in general. Fraternities are just for rich kids that do nothing but help them get through a high-end, high-popular, trendy university with a good name so they can get into high-paying and, you know, jobs and powerful, like, government jobs. And you get examples of stuff like George Bush or something that's had a C average and becomes president. And it's all because of fraternities who give them, answers to tests and help them get through without really learning the classes or really getting the marks.
Well, there's no question that fraternities are among the most privileged spaces on college campuses. And in the book, I look particularly at the University of Alabama, which kind of typifies the big public flagship public university, where fraternities have a real lock on social life. And where the fraternities, particularly the sort of what they call the old row fraternities, will recruit young men in high school, and will look at the same families at the same schools and pick them even before they get to campus. Which means that if you're an outsider and you're not someone of means. Also, if you're African American, for instance, because these were historically white fraternities, you have very little chance. And in fact, in many of the fraternity chapters that I looked at the University of Alabama, they had no black members, and some had never had any black members. And going back again to the University of Alabama, which I think has maybe an extreme example, but it sort of offers a roadmap to what you describe, the fraternities have such a lock on student government. They have actually another, even more secret organization called The Machine, which picks candidates for the presidency of the school and for other offices. And once again, those positions will help people in Alabama rise to higher office in Congress. So it is definitely a very powerful network. And, you know, I think that what fraternities will say is that they have opened up somewhat over the years, and that you will find that there are chapters at some schools that are more diverse. But, you know, it costs money to pay dues, and you need to have time to do to go to the parties. And if you're a first generation and or you're African American, you're very likely to you're very unlikely to find your way into these historically white fraternities that are so powerful. So I think there's certainly some truth to that statement. I have, you know, I spent a lot of, almost, you know, more than 2 years talking to men all over the country. I did find some that were not from wealthy families who felt that this was valuable and did help them. So, you know, I don't think this is, it's not every fraternity and every chapter. And it might depend a bit on the part of the country, but on the whole, every survey that I've seen has found that people who belong to fraternities tend to be from higher income brackets and tend to be, you know, more white than the rest of the college.
At this point, you know, if you're a poor child coming into a fraternity, what is the benefit of actually joining? If you think that you're going to be an outcast or an outsider.
Well, I mean, there was a study that came out a couple of years ago that looked at earnings at fraternities and found that people who joined fraternities tended to get lower grades but had something like one-third higher incomes. So if you can afford it, or if the fraternity gives you a break and it helps you get your first internship and your first job, it can be very, very powerful. And there are a lot of examples of people whose fraternity brothers help them with their careers and, you know, help them with the transition into life. So, I mean, these are, in many cases, kind of exclusive clubs, and they're exclusive for a reason. They benefit the people who belong. And the bigger question really is whether they benefit the colleges and whether the culture, particularly the heavy drinking, is something that is worth the benefit that they clearly have for some members.
So why do they have such stringent majors, you know, to join? I mean, I'm looking back at my college days, you know, and of course I was always military. I'm looking back, you know, and I'm almost ashamed, you know, at some of the parties that, you know, we had. But I don't remember it being this stringent, almost to the point of being lethal.
Are you talking about the really, really aggressive hazing?
Yes.
I mean, that's something that, again, goes back to the 19th century. You can find deaths from people being blindfolded and falling off of cliffs. And one of the major differences now is that there's been this combination of initiation and drinking, particularly hard alcohol. So a common hazing technique is to give a recruit, you know, a bottle of liquor and say, you know, you can't come out till you drink it. And that's enough, you know, to kill people who don't have high tolerance to alcohol. And we've seen that again and again. And there's some misguided sense that this is the way to create some kind of cohesion or brotherhood, that, you know, I went through this, you go through this, and so we'll, you know, we'll have run the gauntlet. And, you know, I think the military analogy is apt. You know, the military had a tradition of having drill sergeants really abuse young recruits.
Yes.
And although that still happens, and there have been some pretty horrendous cases, the military has tried to get away from it, because what it really does is you know, give a home to sadists and discourages people from speaking up when there's something terrible is happening. I mean, one of the most disturbing parts in that I found in my book is are cases where you have a young man who is clearly dying or in danger, and where the right thing to do is to call 911. And because of this culture of doing what you're told by the older men, no one does. And that's what's sort of figured in some of the most horrific cases in my book, but also more recently at Penn State, where a young man named Timothy Piazza was asked to drink something like 18 drinks in, I think it was an hour and a half. And
oh, wow.
Stumbled down a flight of stairs and hit his head and was horribly injured and kept falling. And his brothers, so-called brothers, were seeing this. And some even said, look, we really need to call for an ambulance. And others said, no, you know, he'll be okay. He'll sleep it off. And this was all captured on surveillance tapes that happened to be in the basement where this happened. There was opportunity after opportunity. But because of this culture of not challenging the higher authorities, and because of the secrecy, and because the fraternity in that case had lied about its pledge program, they didn't do it, and he died. And now dozens of men are still facing criminal charges. And, you know, this is a real, you know, the family has made this a crusade and is pushing for better laws and, you know, better behavior of fraternities.
Yeah, correct. Now, I'm not going to speak for Al. I will speak for myself. You know, I have graduated college. You know, I've got 2 degrees from 2 different universities. And I have never seen the need to join a fraternity. However, I have been in the military, and I'm getting ready to retire from the military, which are, you know, similar organizations. And I understand hazing. But, you know, I think, you know, kind of the belief here is that nothing brings a group together like a mutual suffering. You know, why alcohol? Why do they choose alcohol or drugs?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I think part of it is that there's a culture already of binge drinking at fraternities. And I found that studies showed that something like 90% of fraternity men binge drink. And that's twice the level of the rest of the population. And so this is already part of their behavior in general. And that kind of binge drinking that they do is dangerous in and of itself. It's dangerous, you know, it's obviously bad for your health. It risks hospitalization and alcohol problems later in life.
Mm-hmm.
So that culture then goes in, you know, comes into the kind of sort of toxic manliness that they're promoting, that you need to hold your liquor, that you need to be tough.
And yeah, but
you need to be able to handle yourself.
Why not the silly games? You know, let's do this, let's do that. You know, what is it about alcohol? You know, following the pattern, years down the road, it's going to be crack. You know, let's see how much crack you can do before you pass out.
Yeah, I mean, there, you know, drugs are an issue too, but alcohol is definitely, particularly hard liquor, is perhaps the central hard problem that fraternities have faced. And in fact, the North American Interfraternity Conference, which oversees the sort of oldest fraternities, has recently initiated a ban on hard liquor at fraternity gatherings, which the question is whether they can enforce it. But, I mean, they see that this is a problem. But this is, yeah, again, there is something cultural going back to the 19th century. And I found cases where, you know, fraternities were organizations that, on the one hand, were rebelling in a good way. They were early 19th century colleges were places that encouraged the study of theology and Latin and Greek, which was all fine and good, but you had a generation of young men who wanted to be movers and shakers, and they wanted to study modern subjects like American literature and poetry. And so they were, in part, reading clubs. They were sort of breathing new life into colleges. But they were also rebels. You know, they gambled and they drank heavily and they even rioted. You know, there are cases in the book where I talk about, you know, these bands where they take over and they, you know, they take over buildings and they're drinking and they're harassing women. So there's just some kind of sort of rebellious, riotous streak that goes through these organizations that they kind of have to reckon with.
I noticed on the article that you had sent me from before, just in Bloomberg, about the death at Delta Sig and Deborah Tipton. So in that case, just as many others, it seems like what happens is someone ends up dying from over-drinking, usually, and being left for a long period of time, or long enough where they succumb to being, you know, overdosed. And quite often the people, if you know, the people that were around them at the time, even if they go to court or get charged, quite often they get off. They don't really serve time. Is that going to change, or is this something we can expect to keep on happening?
Well, I think there's been something of a change in that because of social media and these other technologies like surveillance cameras, there's a lot more evidence than there used to be. It's very hard for any kind of behavior from, you know, a drinking death to an offensive party to go unrecognized. And so the evidence is there. It's amplified. And you have families like the Tipton family, who are determined to change laws and to make sure that these cases get prosecuted. And there are a number of reasons they don't. One is that in most states, hazing is a misdemeanor that can be punished, punishable by as little as $500. So you're not going to see police invest a huge amount of energy into hazing cases. They'll pay attention if something terrible happens. And then after a case is brought, it's very difficult. There's kind of a code of silence among the brothers not to come forward, which in many ways is misguided because they should care about their brother who lost his life. In the case in the Tipton family's case, the police did not investigate that thoroughly, at least according to the documents that I reviewed and the sort of interviews that the family did with the police detective. And there were a bunch of leads where it looks like, you know, one of his fraternity brothers, after he died, got a hold of Robert Tipton's phone and deleted a bunch of messages on his cell phone. And then later, the same brother went with a bunch of other members of the fraternity to Memphis, where the Tipton family lived, for the funeral. And during the funeral, went so far as to sneak into his room and find his laptop and find documents about the fraternity, presumably about hazing, perhaps, or drug use at the fraternity, and delete them as well. And he acknowledged this in depositions related to the lawsuit that the family brought. So this is the kind of behavior that families who are revealing by insisting on more investigations. And so I have some hope that a lot more of the behavior that was sort of swept under the carpet will come to light, and that families will have a much better understanding of the culture and perhaps push for some kind of change.
Now, would it be a fair statement to say that maybe some of these families are being sandbagged by previous members of said fraternities?
Well, I think what I have noticed is that if you go to a university website, you'll see, you know, Office of Greek Life, and you'll look, and it'll sound very innocent, and it'll sound wonderful, leadership, scholarship, philanthropy. They'll talk about the grade point averages of the chapters. And maybe if in some schools there'll be a link to some kind of discipline, but it's usually very vague. And so they offer a lot of reassurance. It's almost an endorsement of Greek life. And that's something I think that will have to change. The president of Penn State is pushing for some kind of scorecard and better disclosure of discipline that would be sort of uniform across colleges. I mean, it would help the better chapters if this kind of information were available to families so that you could look and see that this chapter is responsible and this one isn't. But sort of a blanket endorsement of fraternities, which is kind of what most schools do, does lead to kind of a sandbagging of families. I know Deborah Tipton didn't realize what her son was getting into. She was actually, and she wasn't particularly suspicious of fraternity life. She was a member of a sorority at the University of, Vanderbilt University. And her father had been a member of SAE at the University of Virginia. So she wasn't predisposed to think one thing or another.
Right.
I think having some information about it would have been helpful.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Or, you know, or here's our criteria. You've got to do A, B, C, D in order to be a full-fledged member. You know, this is the pledge. This is this step. This is this step. You know, maybe outline something so maybe somebody could choose something that is not so stringent.
Well, the other thing is just to be, you know, the research in terms of hazing, the research that the best research I found, which was actually funded by Greek organizations, found that 75% of fraternity members are hazed, and the most common form of hazing involves alcohol. So this is the rule, not the exception. And that's yet if you go to any fraternity website, the national organization or the university, it will say we have a zero tolerance policy about hazing. It is completely not allowed. And so what's happened is that the fraternities are making a distinction between hazing, which I guess people consider as sort of the most horrible abuse, the physical beatings or the, you know, waterboarding and the forced drinking until you pass out, and they're not talking about the pledge program. So the pledge program sounds fairly innocent. It sounds like something, it's educational. But in most cases, it's kind of a cover for this kind of hazing. So you'll see them maybe have to dress all the same or wear a funny hat or wear a t-shirt, maybe do some cleaning up after the chapter, but
yeah, sure.
You know, when the lights go out, things get really bad. That was one of the cases in the book. I wrote about a young man who, you know, wanted to join a fraternity at Salisbury University in Maryland, and he wanted to work on Wall Street. He wanted the connections, he wanted the social life. And so he got interviewed, and it was like there was like a boardroom. Everything seemed really on the up and up. And the university made him go in and look at the rules, and it said, you know, hazing will not be tolerated. We have a zero tolerance policy. He signs it. So he's really reassured that this is going to be a good experience. But almost immediately, he is taken through sort of a horrific gauntlet. In one case, he's taken to a basement. The windows are darkened, and there's a stereo down there, and they pound. It's an ear-splitting volume, the same German heavy metal song over and over again. I mean, it was like something out of Clockwork Orange or something, Guantanamo Bay is what he described it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they would come in, and they would yell at him and throw bottles. And, you know, this is just the beginning. Another night, this is like in March, it was cold. They would ask the young men to be stripped down to their underwear and go outside and step into a garbage can filled with ice while they were sprayed with water. And then the part that I found most ironic is that they would be asked to recite the creed of the universe of Sigma Alpha Epsilon, which is called the True Gentleman, which is the title of the book, comes from that creed, which is supposed to be about honor and friendship and integrity, and here you are having to say it while you're being essentially tortured. This is the kind of thing that happens, and then it's denied. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, this incident had never come out before we uncovered it at Bloomberg by getting some of these internal documents from the university, which showed that you know, they had documented this. And we tracked down people who were in the basement and found a pledge who dropped out who corroborated a lot of what he said. So I had no doubt that this had happened. But to this day, and on the local level, the national fraternity believed that this had happened. But the local alumni who often fight the shutting down of the chapter still sort of say this was blown out of proportion. That's the challenge.
Wow. Now, John, you know, and I'm speaking as a member of a fraternal organization. What is the purpose of such a violent initiation? Well, why? I mean, you know, there are so many things that you could do. You know, so much you can require of a member. Why such violent and meaningless? You know, meaningless violence.
Well, I mean, that's really an excellent question. And one of the things that really I found inspiring in the course of researching the book is that after all of these deaths, there were 10 at SAE, the national organization decided that, indeed, there was no reason to have not just hazing, but to have any kind of pledge program. They decided this was normally fraternities are sort of self-governed. Usually the undergraduates would have to approve this. They decided to take an emergency measure because things had gotten so dangerous and their insurance company was threatening to revoke its policy. They decided that they would eliminate any kind of pledge program. In other words, you would pick a young man to join and he would become a member almost immediately. The idea being that there wouldn't be this 6-week or 2-month period where they were sort of provisional members, where they were most likely to be abused. And what's really interesting is, you know, a lot of people in the fraternity said, you know, this is not going to work. There was a lot of backlash against it, but it held up. SAE had to shut down multiple chapters. I think what I looked at was more than 30. I think it might be more than 40 now because many would not comply. But it did have a big effect in the years after I looked. You know, they used to have something like 13 insurance claims a year. It went down to 2 until, unfortunately, recently, in a case that hasn't really been sorted out yet. There hadn't been any deaths since like 2014. So, I mean, it's not perfect. The people who instituted the policy are the first to say that hazing didn't disappear, but it became much more difficult. And so I think it's clearly not necessary. Sort of people who are fraternity historians talk about how at the very beginning, most of the fraternity started without any kind of pledge program. It was probably, usually it's 4 to 6 or 10 men got together and formed this group, and they didn't put themselves through any kind of gauntlet.
You know, even without the issues that these fraternities have and deaths, why do universities promote them then on their website? Like, what's in it for the university to say something good about fraternities?
Well, fraternities, they're very popular. It helps recruit students who want to have a healthy party scene. A lot of the public universities, which have these huge fraternities, huge fraternity populations like Ohio State or Indiana University, they recruit students all over the country. So this is a marketing tool. The other reason is that members of fraternities tend to be among the biggest donors to colleges. So I looked at Indiana University. I think they made up something like maybe 20% of their alumni, but 60% of all donations. And if you walked around that campus, pretty much every major building was named after a member of a fraternity. And, you know, the companies that, you know, were big sponsors of the football team had connections to the fraternity. So these are organizations that are, whose members are really sort of foundational to the school. So it is extremely hard to stand up to them. And in the book, I looked at examples where college presidents really had trouble. Probably the most dramatic example was from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, where I looked at a chapter of SAE where during one recruiting period, there had been three young men who had been hospitalized for alcohol, underage recruits, basically. And the dean's office had become extremely concerned and had launched an investigation. And they launched it after having some pretty compelling evidence. They had the police showing up to this party after the initiation, and they had a dash cam video of all these drunk underage students, including one who was so drunk that he tried to get into the police cruiser thinking it was a taxi. And so, you know, there was a closed-door hearing, which I actually got to see the transcript and kind of reconstruct it, where, you know, the students weren't allowed a lawyer, but they had an advisor who was a very powerful state senator who had been a member of the fraternity. And, you know, to make a very long story short, they were, in fact, shut down and kicked off the campus. And the national organization supported that. But the local alumni, who had lots of connections in the state capital in Raleigh, pushed really hard to get new trustees on the board. And the trustees who were members of SAE, and one of them told me that the only reason they joined the board was to get the fraternity back on campus, and that he actually told the president of the university that either SAE comes back or essentially it's your job. You know, do it. You can do it the easy way or the hard way. And then the president confirmed this conversation with me. And after a lot of back and forth, the president left his job and SAE came back. So these are powerful organizations. And there can be consequences for administrators who stand up to them.
Okay, John. You know, we've talked about your usual, you know, your run-of-the-mill fraternity. What about Skull and Bones? I mean, I know the listeners want to know about Skull and Bones.
Well, these are the secret societies at Yale, which were basically offshoots of fraternities. they kind of became separate organizations at Yale. And, you know, these, they also have, you know, they also, you know, are very helpful to people's careers. And there is some difference, though. The secret societies at Yale are now largely co-ed, which is a little bit different. And I don't think there have been the same kinds of deaths. I should say I didn't really research this. There are actually a couple of really good books about secret societies. I'll probably tell you more, but I know a little bit about them. And they were kind of born of the same impulses of fraternities. And one big difference is that the senior societies and the final clubs, for instance, at Harvard, they don't start from the moment you step on campus. So one of the issues with fraternities is that they recruit, you know, freshmen or even high school students who often, you know, their judgment isn't so great. And so some of the most dangerous time for a student is the first few weeks that they come onto campus, and this is when they might, you know, be recruited and be subject to it. I think, you know, a lot of schools have talked about deferring this recruitment till later when you have a broader circle of friends who would basically tell you, you don't need this, you don't need to compromise your dignity to join. So, you know, I mean, in short, these secret societies, I'm sure, have their issues, but they're not nearly as widespread, or they're not in every school. But, you know, they're under, at Harvard, for instance, the final clubs are under assault right now. There's an effort by the school to force the final clubs and the fraternities and sororities to be co-ed because of concern that start out with concern about sexual assault, but also just sort of cultural issues of privilege and drinking and inclusiveness. And so if they're phasing in a policy that if you join one of those organizations that you won't be able to be captain of a sports team or be nominated for a Rose and Marshall scholarship. So they are trying to essentially change those organizations, and they're now facing a huge pushback, including litigation. So that also shows how powerful they are. It's not easy for the schools to take any kind of step.
Yeah, but, okay, John, we're being so polite about this. You know, we've got several presidents who are members of Skull and Bones. Now, when you say that this is not decided whenever a person, you know, shows up at campus, okay, you know, I'm the freshman, I'm signing up for U of A, you know, University of Arizona. I understand this. You know, I get this. You know, I've got to choose, you know, from this organization or this organization, but Skull and Bones has got such a what's the word I'm looking for? Conspiratorial history. You know, that takes some doing to even get the notice of Skull and Bones. You know, let's not be so polite about it. I mean, this is an organization who is choosing world leaders. And the things that we hear that you have got to do to be a member of Skull and Bones, you know, such as, you know, masturbating in a coffin or telling your deepest, darkest secrets, and this is why world events are happening in certain ways because of this organization. You know, how do you answer to that?
I mean, there are people who feel that these kinds of organizations are not productive and kind of, you know, that they shut out a lot of people. You could make the argument that, and I thought about this a lot when I went to visit fraternities around the country, is that one of the things that national fraternities do is they offer a route into this kind of exclusive organization from all kinds of colleges all over the country. So you can join Sigma Alpha Epsilon I think the Yale chapter has disaffiliated, but there is a Harvard chapter, but you can also join at you know, colleges all over the country, at a public university and small liberal arts colleges. So you will have access to that network. So I guess in some ways that offers some of the same appeal of networking and access to power that someone at a secret society might, you know, might have as well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that those issues are somewhat different. And again, I've read about them, and I attended Yale, so I'm familiar with them. But it wasn't really the focus of my book.
Sure. Oh, well, how does somebody get the notice of Skull and Bones? Let's say, you know, I'm a freshman, and I want to join, you know, Lambda, mm-hmm. you know, and you should get a chuckle out of that. But, you know, how do I get the notice of Skull and Bones? You know, what makes me different from any other pledge?
Well, again, I think they're chosen at the end of your college career, so it's often, I am sure that there's some legacy aspect and high society aspect, but also there are people are recruited who are, say, editor of the paper or captain of teams or leaders in other ways. So, I mean, I think then there's also social cachet. But again, since it's secret, I couldn't be sure myself. So, yeah, I mean, I hear you. You know, there are people who feel that that's not something that, you know, that's you're trying to draw a diverse group of people from all over the country from different backgrounds, and why should you divide them when they get to campus? And that's one of the concerns that people have about single-sex organizations, and also, if you're talking about fraternities again, fraternities, because of their history, are already divided by race. There are African-American fraternities, and there are Latino fraternities. Mm-hmm. Women's fraternities or sororities. So, again, they're at a time when people are looking to universities to try to promote diversity and interaction of people from different backgrounds, that there's a real question whether these organizations are working across purposes. And that would be true of, that would be true of the secret societies as well.
You know, and it's not much different outside of the collegiate experience, you know, because, you know, Masons, you know, speaking as a Mason, we have two different organizations. We have the Masons, then we have the Prince Hall, you know, Masons. Hmm. So it's not much different outside of the collegiate experience.
But a lot of schools try to, particularly among first-year students, to make sure people are rooming with, people from all over the country and from different international students and domestic students. And part of the education is outside of class, is learning from your classmates. And in fact, one of the reasons that the Supreme Court has upheld affirmative action, for instance, is not only that it benefits students who receive it, but also that it benefits everyone there, because you're going to be living in a diverse world and have to deal with lots of different kinds of people, and so the university should be somehow reflective of the broader society. So there is definitely a question when you have these kind of elite groups whether it's helping with this mission or hurting. Now, what the fraternities will say is that they are trying to be more diverse, and I have seen chapters that are, but they do have a long way to go.
So now, with all of your research and the timing that you put into it, what do you think should happen with fraternities? Do we need to keep them going, or should they be taken out, gotten rid of?
Well, you know, I'm often asked that question. I don't advocate for a ban, in part because it's not really workable. You know, I think at a university, at a public university, for instance, it's a government organization. The First Amendment protects freedom of association. So, you know, they're going to, you can recognize them or not, but you can't forbid a student from joining. I mean, I think that's fairly clear. Even at private universities like Harvard, which are trying to take steps, they are being sued on a variety of grounds. There have been a small handful of mostly small liberal arts colleges that have banned fraternities like Williams and Amherst. Williams, for instance, did it in the 60s when they were fairly weak and created an entire new residential college system to kind of give students an alternative. And I think Williams would say that it worked quite well. But I just think it's not something, first of all, legally that's easy to do, and also because of the power of fraternities and the popularity of fraternities. It's something that people want. They house a quarter of a million students, so the biggest landlord for students after the universities themselves. It would be extremely difficult. So, you know, what I talk about in the book is ways to reform fraternities. And, you know, the first would be to take any step that you can to cut back on their drinking. So that would be enforcing the drinking laws at fraternity chapters, getting fraternities to ban hard liquor, and as some fraternities have actually done, to ban alcohol in chapter houses. I write in the book about Phi Delta Theta, which is one of the largest fraternities, which was struggling with a number of deaths in the 90s up to 2000. And Phi Delta Theta instituted a policy of dry chapter houses. And since then, actually until last year, unfortunately, they hadn't had a single death. But more important, you know, even more significantly, their claims went down something like 90%. So they were generally safer. Now, that's not to say that everyone who belongs to Phi Delta Theta, you know, adheres to these policies. That's often a reason you hear, well, you know, you can't eliminate it, so we can't do anything. I look at this as a public health issue. So, you know, the United States decided that smoking was a terrible thing, and there would be all kinds of efforts, making it more expensive, public service announcements, better information. Mm-hmm. And there's been a huge reduction in smoking, same with drunk driving. So that has to be kind of a university-wide crackdown on drinking at fraternities.
Now, thank you for talking about your book and about the fraternities. A book, again, it's called True Gentlemen, and it's by John Hechinger. And you have a website as well or something so people can get to it?
I do. It's johnhechinger.com, johnhechinger.com. And I have information about articles and the book and fraternities in general. So and there are ways to contact me through the website as well. And Al and Kevin, I really appreciate your having me on for your show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.